ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on ABC Radio National. For nearly 40 years, the show has been asking the best writers, thinkers, and provocateurs big questions about our changing world.
It's a power grab in advance.
But as institutions collapse, narcissists thrive.
And people were willing to take risks.
4 brand new episodes each week on the ABC Listen app.
Walk through an art gallery and sometimes the works just really connect, don't they? They cut through to your soul. Sometimes, though, they can leave you for cold or the artist statements read like gobbledygook. Today on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, what artists see. We're making sense of the messy, the human heart of art. Hello, Natasha Mitchell, bringing you Big Thinkers at the best live events. And today it is the award-winning arts writer, author and critic, Quentin Sprague. He has worked as a curator, an academic, an art coordinator and an artist. He went to art school. But he also has this unusual gift to help others see the power of art through his words. And his book, The Stranger Artist, about the Aboriginal art movement, won the 2021 Prime Minister's Literary Award for Nonfiction. And I really love this description of his latest collection of essays, which is called What Artists See, by author, poet and visual artist Kim Mahood. She says, the artists included in this collection occupy a spectrum from the hyper-visible to the quietly inscrutable, from an Aboriginal late bloomer to a postmodern iconoclast, from artists navigating marriage to each other to the loner grappling psychosis into calibrated order. I want to read this collection, but time for the storyteller of art to share some of his story with historian and Professor Emeritus Mark McKenna. They're at the Australian National University's Drill Hall Gallery. And they're kicking off with Quentin's childhood on a farm on the Monaro Plains in New South Wales, with long drives to the nation's capital and its galleries, which I gather is where he starts his book. And a warning for Indigenous listeners, today's episode does contain the names of people who have died.
When I sort of think back to a landscape, you know, there's a few landscapes that return to me, and the Monaro is one of them. Mm. You know, that's where I essentially grew up. We moved from there to Canberra in 1990, but through the 80s we lived there on a house that was on a pretty much otherwise unadorned hilltop, looking out across the paddocks towards the snowy mountains. And that sort of, you know, the visual intensity of that landscape is something that's always stuck with me. Mm. And as I write in that first chapter, that passage, you know, that sort of journey we would take from near Nimitabelle to Canberra was often to sort of see, you know, quote-unquote culture in the so-called big city, which it wasn't very big then. But,
no, you actually say Canberra was more a city in name rather
that's
than
right.
any other
yeah.
sense at the time. And but the journey to the National Gallery was really pivotal, wasn't it?
It was. You know, so in the National Gallery opened in 1984, and we would have started visiting soon after that. You know, I had no idea it had just opened as a child, but, you know, I came to know certain works in that collection, and as I write in the introduction, it was two paintings by the late great American artist Philip Guston that really stuck with me. Mm. And so I sort of used the introduction to this book, the first essay, to look at those works again from the perspective of now.
And yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful connection from the Monaro to the National Gallery and then to Guston.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a story where Quentin explains the moment where he takes a postcard. You take a postcard from, it's the work, Guston's work, The Pit, I think.
That's right, yes.
And you take the postcard and you pin it above your bed at Nimitabelle, close to the window where you sometimes gaze out at night, unable to sleep.
That's right, yeah.
Is that the do you see that now? I mean, you know, looking back, do you see that moment as the moment you first realised you were connecting with art through Guston's work?
Well, in, you know, there's a lot of benefit in hindsight, you know.
Sure.
But, I mean, there's a number of things about Guston's work which are absolutely compelling. But that work in particular, it's literally a painting of a sort of a figure kind of trying to sleep in a pit, you know, surrounded by, you know, the weight of history, which is painted as this sort of pile of knees and legs and boot heels. And the figure is a sort of a single-eyed kind of bulbous-headed cartoon character, really. So there's something in that visual language, which Guston, you know, he really, when he made those paintings late in his life, he reached back to his childhood, and he, you know, particularly to his fascination and passion for sort of syndicated cartoons, such as Crazy Cat. So there's something in the line that, you know, is childlike.
Yeah.
There's something in the sort of searching quality of his picture making that is childlike. So it's no surprise to me that these were the works that sort of captured me as a child.
As you describe how your view of that particular work changed,
it changed.
You go back to the National Gallery when you're an established writer, a critic, and you look at the painting again and you see things that you didn't see before. What changes? What do you see?
Well, Guston was a figure who dealt with emotional turmoil for most of his life. He was a depressive, and I always saw that picture as a picture of despair, right? Mm. And in a lot of ways it is. It's a picture of despair about, he was an American painter. America, 20th century America was his great subject, so it's a picture of despair about the political and social situation that he was living in. Mm. But I also saw it as a picture of personal despair and the despair of the artist, right? Mm. More recently, perhaps my worldview has become a bit more sort of positive, but I came to see that as a picture of an artist at work. You know, the eyeball on this figure is wide open and the world around him is pressing in and he's looking, right? Mm. So this idea of looking becomes one of the symbols that passes through the book.
Yeah.
So it's the base level thing of what an artist does.
And your mother Annie's quite a pivotal figure, it seems, too, because you're born into this household that has such a strong interest in the arts generally and bookshelves full of books like the one you just mentioned. How do you look back on that now?
Well, it was relatively unique for that area. My mother was born into a farming family and she went away. She married my father, who was, he was an artist and still is. But they lived in the city, so she sort of was part of the counterculture. She brought back, when she returned to the Monero, this sort of interest in, you know, a sort of more urbane and cultural world, right? Mm. Which is what she dipped into. So we sort of had, in a way, like that was coming into our house through books largely, but then through these other sort of interests.
I'm really struck by the way that you describe often throughout the book your own work as looking closely, obviously, and attempting to feel your way through art. Where does that ambition to feel your way to and through art sit with conventional ideas of what art criticism is?
Look, I think a lot of my motivation as a writer is to slow down the experience of art for myself, first and foremost. And often I do that by attending to the work itself, but also by seeking out certain artists and talking to them, you know. And I know that loosely what I do and what I do in this book is sort of classified as art criticism.
Loosely?
Loosely.
Loosely.
But I prefer to call myself a writer, and this isn't a sort of a way of making a distinction between one thing and the other, but I think as a writer you're allowed not to know, whereas a critic you're expected to know.
Yeah, there's that sense of critical assessment, judgment.
Yeah.
Which is based, of course, I mean, the knowledge base required to be a critic is quite considerable. Mm-hmm. And as you say at one point, the art world is extremely good at finding ways to make art seem complicated, right? And obviously you're kicking against that, right? You don't want to make your writing and you don't want to make the art and the artists that we're reading about seem complicated. And so I'm wondering, how do you balance this maybe expectation in a way for critical assessment with the more intuitive response? When I read your work, I wouldn't describe it as art criticism, because it's really trying to take us inside the artist's creative inspiration, their mindset, all of the things that impact on their ability to work.
Mm-hmm.
And you're exploring more than you're assessing, right? Reader's eyes.
That's the way I intend it in a way. And I think, look, at a certain point, I decided to try and write things that I wanted to read,
mm-hmm.
you know, or that I...
Good idea.
Which sounds dismissive of things, you know, and there's plenty of heavy lifting one has to do as an art critic or whatever you're doing. You have to read things that might not sort of, you know, draw you through in the way, you know, a novel does, right? But I think the revelation I had, and it's no revelation to anyone who's been a writer or is a writer, is that probably the most compelling thing about every story is the human story, right? It's the human component that you're going to connect to as a reader.
Mm.
And when I interview artists or I seek them out, I stay with the ones who can access that story about their work. And it's not always the case. I mean, you can have very interesting conversations with artists which are sort of about theory and, you know, the conceptual basis of work, and, you know, some of that bleeds into this book, definitely. Mm-hmm. But I've come to really admire those artists who live in the unknowing aspect of making work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And have learnt to sort of find a way to embrace that and to articulate it.
You say at one point, one of the qualities that draws me to paintings is that they're mute. They communicate, right? Nonetheless, they still communicate because they describe feelings and memories and scenes in fine detail. This is a mysterious process, you say. This mute thing, the challenge of giving literary form to that mystery of communication, to giving it shape and form on the page.
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant challenge for a writer to have a visual prompt like that and to have to describe things. And, you know, for a brief time I taught in a university and I would remind people to describe the work in question, you know, it's a simple thing, but people often forget, you know, let's just describe the thing. And I think as a writer, it's a beautiful challenge that artworks give you, because as soon as you start describing it, they kind of open up.
It's a challenge that Quentin Sprague tackles in his new collection of essays titled What Artists See. And you're listening to Quentin in conversation with historian and author Mark McKenna here on Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell. Now let's dive into the stories Quentin unearths about the artists in his book, including acclaimed Australian-Malaysian artist Simran Gill, who warns Quentin not to trust the artist biography.
The hinge between the life and the work is illuminating, right? Mm. And I like reading biographies about any range of people because, you know, that it explains, you know, the motivation to do the thing, right? In this case, to make the art. I know why people are sort of doubtful or mistrustful of the biography as the only interpretive frame. But I think in terms of art, you've got to go, you know, you've got to sort of go between the two. And Simran Gill's a really interesting example because a lot of her work does you know, have a very sort of close relationship to where she is in the world at a given time, right? Mm-hmm. Almost to the point where she takes visual sort of imprints of the world as it surrounds her. So there's a kind of a mass of material in her practice that is, in a way, biographical, and it's very much, I mean, she's one of the artists who I keep coming back to when I think about art, because she's so good at sort of, making the relationship between work and life a one-to-one relationship and a meaningful relationship, one that the work holds out, right?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, there's something kind of cheeky about her comment there. But she's also, I think, probably, she's quite a literary artist. She writes very well and she reads very well. And I suspect she's also referring to the fact that there's a level of construct in every, you know, in memory to start with, in the interpretation of memory, and then in the interpretation of, you know, that material by, you know, the writer or the biographer.
And
For me is where it becomes most interesting, you know.
I mean, related to that, I'm just wondering, do you know how many of your artists are keepers of their own past? I mean, their archival consciousness, I mean, are they, on the one hand, sometimes dismissive of biography at the same time as they're keeping everything about their own practice, existence, etc.? Are they keepers of their life experience and records?
It's a good question. The answer is no, I don't know how much. But you do go to an artist's studio, whatever that consists of, sometimes a physical space, other times a kitchen table, and you do sense the archive that people are gathering around them, and from that you can read a great deal. You know, for someone like myself, that's as interesting as, you know, the discussion. You see the things, and Ken Wisson was sort of interesting for me in this regard, because concurrently to talking to him and visiting him, I was actually going through archives that were held, either through his galleries or in state gallery collections. Mm-hmm. You know, so there was a sort of I was sort of running both methods at the same time and using that archive to sort of come back to Ken and talk to him about certain aspects of his life, much of which he had forgotten. So I was actually
that's always an interesting sort of comparison, isn't it, where you look at a record of a past event in one's life and then compare it to memory. It's always can be quite revealing.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's the thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So let's dive into some of the essays. I guess, you know, one of the themes that obviously runs through the book, many of the essays, is obsession, right?
Mm-hmm.
The total commitment of required to create art. In two of the book's opening essays, one on Stuart Ringholt and his work, The Nuclear Clock, and another on the collaboration between the artist Mike Parr and printmaker John Lone, we really see the extent, in different ways, right, of their total devotion to their practice. So first to Stuart Ringholt and his Nuclear Clock, I wonder if you can just tell us a little bit about Ringholt's struggle, firstly with psychosis, which you write about, and this years-long three-ton work, I think, The Nuclear Clock, which you actually say stretched his, you know, belief in art to its limit.
Yeah, it's a fantastic story, Ringholt's story. I was familiar with his work for quite some time, you know. He sort of came into the Melbourne art world probably in the early 2000s. He moved from Perth, and he always had this kind of rare commitment to what he was doing. At that stage, he was sort of becoming quite well known for performance pieces where he involved participants in, you know, certain kinds of performative acts. There was a performance that he did called the Funny Fear Workshop, where people would bring in, you know, these sort of hugely embarrassing things, but minor things that might have happened to them in their lives, and they would reenact them, right, in public.
Right.
And, you know, so there was always this kind of drive behind Stuart's practice, which was fascinating and rare. And the basis of it was an experience he had in his late teens or early 20s. He went travelling. He ended up in India, off the beaten track, you know, sort of doing the great sort of backpacker's journey around India, which included smoking a lot of hashish.
Yes.
And he descended into psychosis, and he was hospitalised in India, brought back to Australia, and he ended up doing two stints in the, I think it's called the Greylands Psychiatric Ward in Perth. So he almost lost, you know, his capacity to be in the world. And, well, he did for periods. And making art was one of the things that allowed him to come back. And early on, he did a performance privately where he reenacted some of the things that he was doing in the throes of psychosis. Right.
And he published a book about
it. And he eventually, you know, he wrote a manuscript and he self-published a book called Hashish Psychosis, What It's Like to Be Mentally Ill and Recover, right? Mm-hmm. And this was an artwork first, then it was a book. It was a book mainly because he wanted, you know, that kind of material when he was trying to get better, and it didn't exist, so he made it. So he has this great line in the essay I write about him where he says, you know, my art healed me.
Yeah.
And the art world doesn't like to sort of hear things like that, but it's true. It was healing, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the basis of his practice. And he sort of diversified into all these very interesting works and periods. And by the time I come to him, he's at the tail end, or he's finished essentially the second of these two huge sculptures, which are oversized clocks. The first one's sort of 3 meters tall. He builds it with a horologist from Sydney, and I can't remember which is which, but one of them, I think the first one runs fast, and the second one runs slow.
Slow, yeah.
He builds the first one and he decides that he can do the next one himself. So he builds this thing that he eventually calls the nuclear clock. He outsources, you know, various parts of it, but he essentially builds the whole thing from scratch. Yeah. It costs a huge amount of money and it pushes him.
Yeah.
It's
obsession writ large, really.
I mean,
he slows this nuclear clock, right? He slows the rhythm of the clock so it stretches the length of the day to 33 hours. And you write that that'll be actually the length of the day on Earth in 900 million years' time or something like this.
That's right, yeah.
When the Earth's rotation is slowed to that point. But you also describe the beauty, the incredible beauty of this work.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I don't know if I should admit this, but I've only seen photographs of it. And the reason for that is it's only been installed once in Japan.
Yeah.
And it's so expensive to freight and to put together that since this sort of brief exhibition at a Triennale in Japan, it's sat in his studio in crates.
And it's so heavy that when I think one Australian gallery decide they might exhibit it, they then realise they can't because their floorboards aren't strong enough to take the weight of the thing.
That's right, yeah.
So, yeah, incredible.
And it's like, you know, I think of this work, you know, the two clocks are two of the best artworks of the 21st century in Australia. And you sort of see this commitment, it's financial, it's emotional, it's like intellectual work.
Yeah. But it gives and takes, yeah? You actually write, obsession gives and takes, yeah?
Yeah, and he said to me, you know, I think you know, it almost broke my relationship with art. You know, before that, it was always a good thing. It was like a good relationship, and this almost broke it, this piece. Mm. Yeah.
So if we move now to the second essay in this sort of obsession couple, in a sense, that's the relationship between Mike Parr and the printmaker John Lone.
Mm-hmm.
And this collaboration relationship begins late 80s, I think.
1987.
And when Lone finds himself drawn to Parr's drawings.
Yes.
I think. I mean, it's a long period of collaboration. Could you just say something about their relationship and how it developed and worked?
Yeah. Yeah, so look, a lot of people here this evening may know John, and they may know what a master printmaker is. But essentially it's someone who works with artists to realise editioned works, right, whether they're screen prints, etchings, whatever. John Lone when he met Mike was at the tail end of running something called the Australian Print Workshop in Melbourne, and he cut out on his own and basically had a business as a master printmaker where he would edition works for artists. And this brought him into a collaborative relationship with Mike Parr, who's really best known as a performance artist in Australia, a particularly uncompromising one. He was born with a congenital birth defect, which means his right or left arm, yes. I can't remember which, finishes just below the elbow.
Yeah.
So he sort of has this physical sort of relationship to drawing, which I think John Lone really responded to as a printmaker and as a master printmaker. Mm. So they developed a working relationship which went over decades. And for the part of Parr's work, which constituted printmaking, John Lone was really like the key, you know. So they made all that work in collaboration in some way. Mike was always the artist, of course, but it was always hinged on the...
And Lone always says it's his work, doesn't he?
Absolutely,
It's not mine, it's his.
Absolutely. But, you know, it sort of drew them into the very close, very interesting working relationship.
Yeah.
In which, you know, I think they were both had this sort of vested emotional interest in the work.
Mm. And this sort of builds to quite an incredible crescendo moment in the essay where in 2015, I think... there's a Parr's having an exhibition in Anna Schwartz Gallery in Sydney.
In Sydney, yeah.
Yeah. And Lone considers two of these huge works that he was involved in creating as masterpieces, actually.
Mm.
I'll let you explain what actually happens at that gallery. What does Parr do and what does Lone think of doing but decides against it?
Well, by that stage, the work is single state prints. They're not editioned. They only exist as one thing, right? They're made through printmaking, but they're not editioned. And they're very big. They're very impressive. And Mike, he comes into the gallery before the show opens and he decides that this work isn't good enough any longer. He says it doesn't, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but he decides it doesn't reflect him as an artist as strongly as it should. And he thinks I just have to paint over them, right?
And has he done this before?
He hasn't done. This is the first time he does it,
right? Okay,
I believe. Mm-hmm. But the prints, at some level, they do have a sort of a physicality to them, where some of them might have painted elements or whatever. But at this stage, he says, I've got to get rid of them. So he thinks up a performance, and on, you know, the day of the performance, he basically wheels a ladder around the space and he paints each of these large works over in red paint so they become red monochromes.
Mm.
And John Lone is a sort of a... I mean, he's a great collaborator in that he he knew. He said to me, I knew why Mike had to do it, I think. But he said, I had an idea of a counter-protest, which was to stand in between of the work and Mike. But he said, I think Mike would have painted over me too. So I didn't do it.
I get that. I get that impression.
Yeah.
Given that I think a year later, Parr took some other prints to a car park and...
He's done a sequence of works since then. So he's painted other large works over into monochromatic, you know, I think white paintings. Mm-hmm. There was a performance he did at Carriage Works in Sydney where he took a whole selection of unsold editions of previous prints and set fire to them.
Yeah.
So he's folded the printmaking into the performance much more closely than it had before.
Mm. And for Lone, I suppose, you know, there's no more dramatic an illustration of the fact that these works are not his, they're Parr's.
That's right.
Than Parr virtually destroying or painting
them disappear.
Over them. Yeah. So one of my favourite essays in the book is called The House at Glenorie.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really discussing, writing about the house in northwest Sydney that the internationally acclaimed architect Glenn Murcutt designed for the artists Sydney Ball and Lynn Eastaway in the late 70s. The couple lived there very together from 83, I think, until they separated a year later or so.
Yep.
Then Ball stays there for pretty much until he dies, 2016, 17, something like that.
Yeah.
And then Eastaway comes back, and this is where you meet her when she's living there and working there in her studio. I know that Glenn Murcutt's work has intrigued you for a long time. And in this essay, you know, it's what's wonderful about it is that we're taken into the world of three artists, as it were, Murcutt, Ball and Eastaway. That I think is why it seems so incredibly rich to me. There's wonderful quotes from all three artists throughout. Now, one from Murcutt, which I can't but help quote back to you. A building is best conceived as an instrument that the surrounding landscape plays. And also together with that, Murcutt's idea that he designs his buildings not for permanence, but in a way to be dismantled perhaps and reconfigured at a future moment in time. So in all of their creative practices, right, both Murcutt and Ball and Eastaway, you argue, set out not to mimic the bush setting that they're in, but to work alongside it in a complementary manner. Could you just explain how that works at the house at Glenorie and how it worked for all three?
Yeah. Well, Glenorie's I'd never been up there before. It's northwest of Sydney, not far, but, you know, you sort of go through paddocks. You go through suburbia, through paddocks, and then you sort of hit this bushland. And it's regrowth, the block they're on, but it's, you know, it's solid, sort of beautiful regrowth. And I think it's sandstone country up there.
Yep.
And it's quite overwhelming, you know, your senses are kind of, you know, your vision is kind of draws in close in that environment. There's no big vista. I think as, you know, someone who spent a bit of time like in the environment, you know, when I was growing up and various times in my life, it's kind of finding that rhythm between, you know, the place and what you're doing there can be quite hard, you know, isolating sometimes. And I think with artists who live in places like that, which have so much character and so much feeling to them, you know, the challenge is really how to make work alongside it. And I think the worst way of doing it is trying to paint the bush. It's sort of impossible, right?
Yeah.
But Sydney Bohr was pretty interesting because, you know, he had, you know, he was essentially a hard-edged geometric abstract painter. You know, he'd moved to New York a couple of times in his career. He'd sort of been in the orbit of figures like Mark Rothko. So right. he sort of brought this kind of international sort of painting back to Australia in the 70s. In the 80s, he was a teacher. And so when he moved up there, he really initially struggled, you know, to sort of reconcile this language, which was quite minimal, but also quite urban, with this bush setting, you know. And eventually he did it by making hard edge abstraction that sort of mimicked aspects of the bush, but were quite different, you know.
Because there's a point, I think, in the essay where you actually sort of ask a rhetorical question, how do we look at this abstract painting or these abstract paintings of balls, right?
Yeah.
And you say, oh, we look at them in the same way that we look at the bush.
Yeah.
You pay attention.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, talking to Merkert was the revelation of that essay because he was so keyed into that mode of thinking, you know. I mean, he's our great bush architect and, you know, he's sort of spent a career becoming familiar with the site, you know, that he's built on or he's designed on, and finding a way for his buildings not to not to dominate those places, but to sort of be part of them, right? And one of the great things I learned from him, from talking about that house in Glenorie, was, you know, he said that most people make the mistake when they have a house with a big view.
Oh, the view, yes. They want to claim the view.
They want it all.
They must have all of the view.
All of the view all at once.
All at once.
He said, no, no, you can't do that. You've got to have it piece by piece, and then you've got to have some sense of reveal. So there's a way of, like, moving through
the withholding the view is just as important in order.
And, you know, the way those artists work there, and Lynn Easterway, since moving back there, has found her way back into a practice that in a way, like, reflects a way of being in that place, which I think is quite gentle and successful as well. So,
I mean, there's just before we move on from that essay, there's this moment where you talk about Merkert's, one of his great inspirations, a Finnish architect, Juhani Palasma, I think. Who emphasises that it isn't the mind, it's not the mind that consciously guides a creative act, it's the act itself, right? And this runs throughout a lot of the essays,
It's true, yeah.
This idea, and it's not a new idea, surely, is it?
No, it's
that,
not.
That the artist doesn't create, the artist is a kind of conduit or receiver in some ways. They have to listen, they have to be attentive, they have to be in the zone, as it were, right?
Yeah, yeah.
This quote comes from the Finnish architect, but it really runs right throughout the book.
It runs through the history of art to one level, you know, this this idea that there's a intuitive, that art is an intuitive act, and through the intuition you find the work. Ken Wisson was a big advocate of this as well. Most of the artists in here sort of find a way to do that same thing, to you know, the act of making.
I mean, it's true of you too, huh? In a way.
As a writer?
Yeah. As a writer. I mean, it's true of what, of your approach in a way.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you try and find the seed in the conversation that gives you the shape of the book or the essay in this case. But I also went to art school, which is a foundational sort of basis for my thinking. And I think there's a, you know, there's a case that, you know, the way you learn to think in your late teens and early 20s is something you carry through. And learning to think in a studio is a process in which you are encouraged to follow the inquiry first and foremost, right? And I think that's stuck with me.
Art can open up entirely new ways of seeing and feeling the world. It's a case of where or how you choose to look. on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. It's great to have you with me. I'm Natasha Mitchell, and you're listening to arts writer Quentin Sprague in conversation with historian Mark McKenna, who is launching Quentin's collection of essays called What Artists See. Quentin's first book, The Stranger Artist, explored the intersection between the often very white commercial art world and the art of First Nations people. And he returns to this terrain in the story of Cardilt artist Sally Gabori.
Well, there's two parts. One is the art world and its fascinations and obsessions and interests and motivations. And the other half is this sort of amazing woman who lived sort of beyond the frontier for most of her life. Mm-hmm. She was brought from Bentinck Island to Mornington Island in her, I think, early 20s. And then lived on the mission and, you know, had a family and then eventually moved into the old person's home where she was discovered by the art centre and she became a painter. And that essay, you know, that whole, which I've thought about, I mean, that essay has its roots in probably the earliest essay in this collection, an essay I published in the Monthly in 2015, just after she had passed away. That essay is really about trying to reconcile this tension between the market forces that play into this and also the very distinctive and very real cultural aspect of this as well, you know, and...
Because you bring in the time you spent on Melville Island in the Tiwis, right?
That's right, on the Tiwi Islands.
Yeah, in 2007, and how you encountered similar legacies of colonialism you describe.
Absolutely.
That you recognised in Gabori's story on Mornington Island as well. And at a point in the essay, you also connect Gabori's story to the experience you had in the East Kimberley, right? A conversation you have with one elderly artist in the East Kimberley, which struck you as being, in hindsight again, extremely relevant to Sally Gabori's story. What was that conversation? Why did it resonate so much? How did it help you to understand her rise? And, you know, lots of questions rolled into one here, but how you've witnessed and how have you witnessed personally what you call colonialism's extractive urge in the Indigenous art market?
Yeah, it's a big question, Mark.
just slightly. But you deal with it. You tackle it in the essay.
Yeah. No, I do. Absolutely. So that conversation in the Kimberley was with an old man called Churchill Cann, who I didn't know well, but I sat with him at the Art Centre and we were speaking about the art world and... a figure in particular who'd been sort of pivotal in making a painting economy in the East Kimberley. And Churchill said to me that that figure, Tony Oliver, was like the boss of the stock camp. The gallery in the city was like the station owner. And I realised that he was conceiving it. So Churchill had lived most of his life as labour on the stations. He'd been a stockman. So he was conceiving this new economy, the art economy in a local way, which was, about conceiving how the cattle economy had worked previously. Each of them are colonial overlays in that world, and each of them have a sort of a complex give and take where people are exploited and benefit in different ways. And the thing that I do in the essay on Sally Gabori is to sort of sketch out the kind of the social fabric of how a practice like that meets the market. You know, the cultural stuff is secondary in that essay. What I was really interested in doing is like looking at the key players, like who had found her in the old person's home. What were their motivations? Who had been the boss or the manager of the art centre. Who was the gallerist who was involved in these decisions?
Who was, and Brett Evans, who was imprisoned, sentenced to prison for 4 years for embezzling over $500,000 of the funds from the sale of Sally Gabori's paintings.
That's right. So eventually the manager of the community art centre is sentenced to jail for basically, embezzling funds from the paintings over a period of some years.
Yeah.
It's actually a story that's happened previously in other communities around art making. It's probably happening right now as we speak.
You
have to have there has to be a sort of an institutional and moral and ethical framework which stops people.
Yeah, she was so productive that a lot of her work was deemed unsaleable and was disposed of.
Right. And age, I'm interested in age. You raise it in this essay.
Mm.
I mean, I wonder if is age and seniority in the Indigenous art market something entirely of its own? I mean, is there something somehow more authentic, implicitly more authoritative about an older Indigenous artist that is somehow different to non-Indigenous art market?
It's interesting because I've thought about this for some years now, and recently I've noticed it changing. Like there are this kind of group and generation of younger community-based Aboriginal artists who are coming from art centres who are sort of becoming, for want of a better word, stars, right?
Okay.
Previously, however, there has been a disproportionate focus on age, which I think is too easily equated with a kind of an authenticity, right?
Yep.
And a desire for a certain kind of authenticity by a market that's largely driven and comprised of non-Aboriginal people. Mm. So I think that's, and for me, Gabori sort of really filled that space for the art market in a lot of ways. I mean, her origin story was near perfect, She was a pre-contact woman. She didn't speak English very well, if at all.
Mm.
She was old. She carried a lot of cultural knowledge.
Mm. That cultural knowledge, right? I mean, you really get the sense at some points in the essay, just from how you describe and write about it, that there is this kind of feeding of this omnivorous market in the south, east corner, that often predominantly has very little idea about the nuances of that cultural knowledge, or at best only kind of superficial understanding of it.
Yeah.
Yet it's got a feverish hunger for that.
That's right. And art's been a great educator for articulating certain things about the Aboriginal world, but you could also argue that it's been it's also hidden other realities, right?
Yeah.
Because of its focus on certain subjects and certain, cultural subjects as opposed to social ones, perhaps.
Yeah.
And I think the struggle for me when I worked in an Aboriginal art centre or in two different Aboriginal art centres, and the struggle that's sort of at the core of the Gabori story is reconciling the contemporary reality that a lot of the artists are living in and dealing with what the art market perceives from afar. And some of these communities, and Mornington Island certainly one of them, are in and have been in social freefall for many decades now.
Yeah. I'm conscious that we're coming to the end of the discussion. Mm. I've got many more questions about the other essays, but I do want to finish at the point where you finish the book, which is the coda, which really dovetails, I guess, with the introduction to the book. You're in a different landscape, but not far away from the Monaro. Mm. You're down on the south coast of New South Wales, and you're picking blackberries with the artist, Melbourne artist Benjamin Armstrong, and you unpack one of Armstrong's drawings that he shows you while you're there.
Mm-hmm.
What is the drawing? What is the story behind it? And why did you decide to place it in the last few pages?
Ben Armstrong's established himself as a sculptor, essentially, but before that was made beautiful drawings with ink on paper and has done, you know, throughout his career. And at the point I visited, he had an ink painting and ink drawing on paper that he'd done of a kayaker called Andrew McCauley. And it was a selfie that Andrew McCauley had taken as he attempted to cross the Tasman between Tasmania and New Zealand. And for people who know this story, he tried to do it twice. The first time he turned back, and the second time he almost made it, but he died. He sent out a distress call from, I think, 30 nautical miles from the New Zealand coast, and they found his boat sort of floating a few days later, and his body was never recovered. And there's a documentary about him, and there's a scene, you know, which I remember Ben telling me about when we were looking at this drawing, where it's actually his first attempt, and he's paddling away from the shore, and he's just left his wife and his little boy on the beach, and he's crying, and he's saying, "I'm terrified."
He's terrified, Jim.
"I have to keep going." And he does this thing. He comes back on that, but the second time he
doesn't make it.
He doesn't make it. Mm. And immediately there's this kind of question about obsession and it's the dangers of it, right? Also the selfishness of that, right?
Yeah, you write about the violence in a way that he's doing to himself, selfishness of I must do this for myself, despite the fact he fears that he might not see his family again. And then you connect that.
I attempt to connect.
You do. You connect it very powerfully.
I connect this. Well, I actually returned to Philip Guston in that coda because I had recently read a memoir by Guston's daughter, Musa Mayer. And, you know, that's a memoir that really deals with her relationship with her father and in particular the role that art played as this kind of disruptive but generative presence in their relationship, their father-daughter relationship. And it's a very sort of affecting memoir about this, you know, like the love that Guston gave but also had to concurrently give to his work, right? So she was always on the outside. Mm. And again, you know, there's this idea of the obsession becoming the thing that strengthens his place in the world but also, you know, threatens it, right?
Yeah, and I guess the complicity, you know, of all, for every person who's a creative being, and doesn't have to be creative, but it can just be work.
Yeah.
there's a cost to everyone around you for your obsession, for your creative urge that has to be fulfilled.
That's right.
There's a cost worn by others for that.
Yeah.
Who kind of share in it, like it or not, they share in it.
Yeah, and the question in the coda is about the risk of a practice, you know.
And I wanted to ask you if you would just allow me to finish our conversation with you reading the conclusion, which is one paragraph, and I don't think there's anything need to say anything afterwards. It's a beautiful passage of writing, and I think it gives the audience an idea of what makes the book so compelling, not only for people who are inside the art world, but for everyone outside of it as well.
But I still wonder, how and where do you cut away from the push and pull of everyday life and carve out even a small piece of the magnificent solitude a practice demands? At what point does one compromise the other? Did the image of McCauley at sea catch your eye because of his story is such a visceral warning of the dangers of compulsion? Or was it more about the testament it offered to risk, risk being the all-consuming preoccupation for an artist worth their salt?
If you're an artist or you've ever loved one, you will know the truth in those words, the high price some pay for their creative pursuit. For the benefit of all of us. On Big Ideas Today, we've been coming to you from a book launch of What Artists See. It's by the award-winning arts writer and critic, Quentin Sprague, And he was in conversation there with the historian and emeritus professor Mark McKenna. It was recorded at the Australian National University in Canberra. This episode was produced by Grace Pashley with sound engineering from Mark Hennessy and David LeMay. And my name is Natasha Mitchell. I'll catch you next time. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.